offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Niradhyasanam. After a break of a week, we are here to continue with the 1991 summer course series. The last time around, we had completed the 11th discourse in that series, the discourse that Swami delivered on the 31st of May 1991. We're going on to the next discourse. Probably before we start the next discourse, we'll start by sharing some things which Swami said in the previous discourse, just to give you a brief overview of what we heard from Swami in the previous discourse. But before that, as always, we offer our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet, and I invite Brother Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Hari.
To say the least, the last discourse was a beautiful one, especially where Swami speaks about the different types of, or different approaches you can have towards divinity itself. There's always this debate about whether God is formless, or should you worship God with form. You should always worship God as light, as absolute. Many of those things Swami very beautifully put in perspective in that discourse, especially what he drew from the Upanishads, the three ways in which divinity is looked at, where Swami spoke about the Virata aspect, where everything that is manifest, everything that you can see, everything that you can sense through your senses is in fact a manifestation of divinity. And then Swami spoke about the Hiranyagarbha aspect, which is again a very fascinating way of looking at God, where you look at God as a potential entity, where he is in that state where he can become anything, literally like a seed. And that's the example Swami was giving repeatedly, or like the unmanifest stage of a fetus in a womb, where the potential of becoming anything is there.
Any possibility
is available. And we had the company of Pradeep sir, who very beautifully explained some of these things, how they explain in different Upanishads. And one of the things which he said, which was very striking, was any form of worship which is offered to any deity, it could be Rama, Krishna, or any other saint. He said that the Vedas say all of these prayers actually go to the Hiranyagarbha aspect, because that is the unmanifest aspect. And literally we are trying to tweak things there. You know, before it manifests, we want some change. You know, that lottery should fall in my name, or whatever it is. Where there are many possibilities, you're looking for one particular possibility. I think that's what pretty much defines what prayer is, especially when you pray for some particular thing to happen. So he said that that is the Hiranyagarbha aspect. Then Swami went on to speak about the Avyakrita, which is the state where it's beyond even the unmanifest Hiranyagarbha state, where it is. And the correlation between the waking state, the sleeping state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state.
Yeah, because that is a stage where the Upanishad, this Mandukya Upanishad, it refers to that aspect of God as Ishvara himself.
Right.
And so, as you are saying, that the Upanishad actually makes very little distinction between the individual states and the states in which, or the forms in which God appears in those particular states. So it's literally equating the two.
Right.
So, and of course, the Upanishad goes even beyond that to speak about the undifferentiated consciousness.
Okay.
Right. So, this particular Ishvara state is like a block of, they say, like a homogeneous block of consciousness, but something beyond that also. So, that is like they call it the Turiya state, right? Mm-hmm. So that is also spoken of in the Mandukya Upanishad. Mm-hmm. So that there is a mapping between the how an individual experiences the world. So one is in the waking state, and then there is the dream state, and finally you have one of deep sleep, right? So there you have the different aspects of God, but beyond, in the Turiya stage, you cannot actually differentiate either. At least here you can talk of the individual and the God, but beyond that, the Upanishad says there is no distinction.
Exactly. In fact, Swami even refers to as the four different states as the Stula Sukshma, the Karana and the Mahakarana, being equivalent to what you experience in the Turiya state.
Right.
Which is even beyond you don't even have the ability to describe it in words or in any other format, because it's beyond the mind itself.
Correct.
And I think that's what Swami said, that, you know, you can wake up from a deep sleep and say that I had a very nice sleep. Which means even the deep sleep you can experience in a certain level.
Yeah.
But the Turiya is beyond even that form of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then Swami went on to say that, you know, even though God is, you know, in that unmanifest state, even when God manifests in the physical world, He is bound by these four very important entities, the time, task, cause and duty. Kala, Karana, Kartavya and Karma. Kala, Karma, Kartavya and Karana. So he said that, so as long as, even though you, you know, the human beings are also a manifestation of divinity, when in this physical state, you need to follow these things.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami again very beautifully explained how in a dream state you don't have these four things defined, and that's why the dream is unreal, and you don't find the rational in a
it's
dream.
It's more fluid. What happens in the dream state is so fluid that one action or one sequence need not follow, have any bearing to what happened in the previous. You
right.
know, many times you wake up sometimes even thinking of how absurd the dream was.
Mm.
No? So because, but in the physical state, in the waking state, there is a very strong amount of causality. Right? That's why the Swami says Karana.
Right.
So there's a causality principle is very, very strong in the waking state. Right?
Mm.
And that I think was very important, where Swami even spoke of one's Kartavya.
Mm.
Right? What karma. So you have to be very aware, and I think most of Swami's training was that. If I look at it at a physical level, no, like Swami was always making us very, very keenly aware of what our Kartavya at that moment was.
Mm.
Right? So that was the most essential thing. Right?
And the other thing Swami was talking about is, you know, many times even in the waking state, we are not able to come to terms with the causes. You know, what has caused this? Mm. Why this has happened? But in a dream state, the difference is you don't look for the cause at all.
Mm.
You know, there is no seeking for a reason for what is happening.
Right.
Because you probably inherently you know that there is no point in seeking for that.
Mm-hmm.
So in the waking state, even though you might not see causes at times, there
right.
is always a cause, and you always know that there is something.
Correct.
And you are after that. You know, why
right.
did this happen to me? Why me? You know, I've been good to everybody, and why?
Mm-hmm.
You always look for causes. And Swami is saying that that is how it is defined. And again, from there, the very important point, or the very important switch which Swami always makes in discourses, he says everything in the knowledge state is of no use. It has to come to the level of practice.
Mm.
Unless it manifests as the way you make decisions, the way you make choices, the way you act in your everyday life, it doesn't make any difference to you. And that was that part which Swami spoke about. And then from there, Swami spoke about attachment, fear and anger, how they are connected. And how that comes from the fact that, you know, you're still not, the understanding is still not seeped into your mind completely.
Mm.
It is just another knowledge, you know, you learn many talents, that becomes one of the talents. It does not become something which defines what you think and do. And Swami said that is where the fear comes, attachment comes, you like something more than something else. And when that is taken away, or when there is a possibility of that being taken away, then you get scared. And then how anger comes, jealousy comes, Swami was speaking about that. And from there, Swami spoke about human values. And that is a point where Swami spoke very beautifully at length about the importance of Upanishads. And how we think that in the modern context, we don't need to go back to these scriptures. And he was saying that it's all the more reason why you have to go back. Because there is so much clarity in these which is lacking in any other modern texts or modern expositions of human values.
Mm.
So he said it is very important to go back to that. Right? And the last part was of course very beautiful about parenting, and especially the role mothers play. Because there is always this thing of when you're talking about Vedas, when you're talking about very abstract knowledge, they think that the women are actually left out of that. You know, there's always this thing, Gayatri Mantra, women should not chant. But Swami was never for that opinion.
Mm.
In fact, you know, when asked about Gayatri Mantra, apparently Swami had said, Mother Gayatri herself is a woman, why shouldn't women chant Gayatri Mantra? And that particular point, that last part of the discourse, Swami not only said that women should play a role, but he said the primacy of the role,
which pivotal,
play,
very pivotal,
right, very
role.
Important
yeah.
role they play. And he was, of course, comparing and contrasting it with the modern times very, very beautifully. The rhymes that we end up teaching our children today versus what, you know, great mothers like the classic example which Swami gives about Madalasa.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was saying that ancient mothers like Madalasa, how they would, even the lullabies that they would sing, or lullabies, how do you pronounce that?
Lullabies.
Lullabies. Mm-hmm. You know, you always, they always would inject this knowledge into the child, even if the child is not, you know, grown up enough to understand.
Yeah, because there's a lot of pressure to confirm with whatever the trend is. Like, so as we see now, the world is like this. There's such easy exchange of information and all between the so-called Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere that very easily we adopt, you know. So if it is trendy to dance in a certain style, right so then the kids will all be taught that particular form of dance. So the classical traditions that exist that are like grown in this land, they will be discarded and, you know, so that's how it is with music, with so many other things, because so much pressure to confirm, to be trendy. Right? Whereas we don't try to investigate from the base, you know, like how listening to Upanishads, you know, like why would youth be enticed even to discuss about the Upanishads? Because that's not something that they see their peers do. Right? It may be like one in so many few who would suddenly decide. Right? So the same way, because there is a lot of pressure to confirm. Like nobody is independently thinking
right
about life. Right?
Exactly. And, you know, this was Swami's standpoint when in the 1940s when he wrote, you know, poems as a schoolboy.
Yeah.
And I think it's not changed even a bit. In fact, it's got just worse. Right?
Yeah, I was reading, you know, a couple of Vahinis today. And instead of reading the text, what I saw, I started reading Professor Kasturi's prefaces.
Okay.
And in all of them, he's talking about the 1960s. He's talking about how society is spiraling into, you know, decadence. And yes. So I was thinking, if this was what he was speaking about 50 years ago, imagine what it is like, what he would have said today.
Right.
And so I think like every generation finds the same concepts being like very, very relevant, because we keep on diluting, right? So coming down over the millennia, we don't know how much of this message has got diluted in our mind. So it is very important. And luckily for us, what has happened is because of this tradition of very strong. So if the Vedas have been a lot of, other than the chanting that we see, there's the Ganapata, there's the Kramapata, there are different sequences in which the Vedas are chanted by those who have learned them. And this has resulted in the Vedas, the chanting of the Vedas remaining intact over all these millennia. So you may have lost like texts of the Upanishads, but the essence is still the same.
Absolutely.
Right? That's why that message is so authentic. Like, see, the words that have come from the intuition of the sages that have passed like undiluted. Right? So it's like the constitution. No? So you may interpret the law this way and that way, but at least you have something as a basis. Right? So that, in that sense, the Upanishads stand as a basis for everything else.
Right.
You know, there are six systems of the Indian philosophy, but for all of them, the interpretation is the constitution would be the Upanishads. Right.
They look at it differently, but they still go back to the same.
Exactly, they're all the same source. Yeah.
Right. And you know, when Swami declared much early in his avatarhood, he said, "My task is going to be fourfold." You know, he said, in that the first two was Veda Poshana and Vidvat Poshana. Probably people would have thought that Swami is going to have a huge Veda Patshala with yajnas going all through the year. But what Swami has done is, as you were saying, the essence of the Upanishads has been passed on. Because if you go through any of these discourses, of course, this is directly a summer course on the Upanishads. But even other discourses, you would see that it never sways from the message of the Upanishads, the core Upanishadic values which are there. And in fact, Swami only, you know, always drives the similarity between any form of human values you talk of.
Yes.
Even the modern concepts of human values will have their basis or will have their meaningful source from the Vedantic text of the Upanishads.
Yes.
So in that sense, Swami might not have so much invested on, you know, purely Vedic studies, in the sense of he has a modern university, he has a modern hospital. You would probably think that he would have a completely Vedic setup where they're studying the Vedas, or Ayurvedic setup. Swami has not done that, but the essence of the Vedas has always been passed on in the form of these discourses. And that is the beauty, you know, going back to that 18, 19 year olds being spoken to about these Avyakrita and Hiranyagarbha and Virata. And I think that is how Swami has done the Veda Poshana and Vidvat Poshana, through his discourses primarily. So I think that brings us to the next discourse in the series, the 12th discourse. And interestingly, the discourse is titled Spiritual Discipline. So it's almost like Swami has spoken so much about the Upanishads, the various Upanishads. Swami spoke about the Keno Upanishad, the Taittiri Upanishad, Prashna Upanishad. We had three discourses, and Mandukya, the previous one. Now it's almost like Swami is bringing all of them together and say, what are you supposed to do in the form of a spiritual sadhana, discipline? What it really means? Because having heard all of this, probably we'll be inspired to say that, and I want to do some sadhana. But now Swami lays it down, what exactly is sadhana? I think that is going to be the essence of this discourse. So shall we listen to the first clip in that discourse, and we'll discuss after that.
పాపభయంబుపోయె పరిపాటయిపోయెను దుష్కృతంబిలను పాపభయంబుపోయె పరిపాటయిపోయెను దుష్కృతంబిలను శ్రీపతి భక్తి పోయే వివరింపగలేని దురంత కృత్యము దాపురమయ్యే శ్రీపతి భక్తి పోయే వివరింపగలేని దురంత కృత్యము దాపురమయ్యే లోకమున తాపసలోక శరణ్యుడైన శ్రీపతి నామ చింతనమే తాపసలోక శరణ్యుడైన శ్రీపతి నామ చింతనమే చేకురచేయు సుఖంబు మానవా శ్రీపతి నామ చింతనమే చేకురచేయు సుఖంబు మానవా శ్రీపతి నామ చింతనమే చేకురచేయు సుఖంబు మానవా
Fear of sin has disappeared. Wicked actions have become commonplace in the world. Devotion to Lord Vishnu has vanished. The world has become a den of indescribably cruel acts. The Lord, who is the refuge of the ascetic and saintly, chanting His name alone, can grant happiness, O man.
పుస్తకముల్ పఠించితినని పూర్తిగా చూచితి సర్వశాస్త్రము నిస్తులమైన విద్యను నేర్చితినంతును గర్వమేలా నిస్తులమైన విద్యలను నేర్చితినంతును గర్వమేలా నీ హస్తయుగంబు మోర్చి పరమాత్ముని భక్తితో కొల్వలేని ఈ ప్రస్తుత విద్యలన్నీయు తాత్రి నిరర్థకము కదా మానవా తాత్రి నిరర్థకము కదా మానవా జానడు పొట్ట నింపుకొన చిక్కులనుందుచు జానడు పొట్ట నింపుకొన చిక్కులనుందుచు కోటి విద్యలను పోనిగా నేన నేర్చి కోటి విద్యలను పోనిగా నేర నేర్చి జానడు పొట్ట నింపుకొన చిక్కులనుందుచు కోటి విద్యలం పునిగనేర్చి పరిపూర్ణ సుఖంబును పొందలేక ఈ మానవ జాతి మృగగనేల శ్రీ పరాత్పరుం ధ్యానము చేయ దారిని చూపకయున్నే మానవా శ్రీ పరాత్పరుం ధ్యానము చేయ మార్గమును చూపకయున్నే మానవా.
I have read books. I have completely read through all scriptures. Why pride yourself so on acquiring education that is useless? If you cannot join your palms and with devotion worship God, aren't all your studies in this world a complete waste, O man? To fill the stomach that is a few inches long, many a troubles are undergone. Crores of forms of knowledge is acquired. Yet, why does humanity suffer, unable to attain complete happiness? If only you meditate on the Lord, won't He show you the way, O man?
Vidyarthulara.
Students.
Divyattani pundhe nimittamai. Manavudu. అనేక విధములైనటువంటి సత్కర్మలను ఆచరిస్తూ కాలమును కాయమును కర్మమును కూడాను సార్థము గావించుకునే నిమిత్తమై పరిపరి విధముల ప్రయత్నములు సల్పుచున్నాడు.
To attain divinity, man has been performing various sacred activities and has been trying different ways of sanctifying his time, body and his actions.
కాని ఈ సాధనల యొక్క పరిణామము ఈ సాధనల యొక్క గమ్యము సాధనలు అనగా ఏమిటి అనేటువంటి యొక్క అర్థమును గుర్తించి వర్తించుకోలేకపోవటం చేతనే మానవుడు ఎన్ని విధములైనటువంటి సాధనలు సల్పినప్పటికీ తాను ఆశించిన పవిత్రతను పొందలేకపోతున్నాడు.
Since man is not able to recognize and understand the goal and aim of sadhana and what sadhana itself is, he is not able to attain the purity that he aspires for, despite undertaking various sadhanas.
Sadhana ga emito motta motta gurtinchinappude ee sadhyamu aneetundi danini kontha varaku nu pondadaniki veelavutundi.
What is sadhana? When you first understand this, attaining the goal will become possible to some extent.
Kani lokamulo navivida margamulandu ee sadhana salpuchu kevalamu dani yokka antaratmanu gurtinchukoleka kalamunu kayamunu kartavyanni kudanu vyattham gavinchukuntunnaru.
But in the world, people practice sadhana through the 9 paths of devotion without recognizing their inner significance, thereby wasting their time, body and duties.
That was the first clip, and Swami sang two beautiful long padyams to start with in that discourse. Swami was talking about what we were referring to, the change in the society, and invariably most of the discourses start with the reality check in that sense. About what's going on in the world. So we're saying the fear of sin has disappeared, the wicked actions have become commonplace, devotion to Lord Vishnu is absent, and the world is a den of indescribable cruel acts. And to say that this was in the 1991, how relevant it is even today, you know. Sadly, after 25 years, we just can't say that, no Swami, this is of that time and it is not true now. That's the sad thing. But this is something which Swami would often refer to, the fear of sin and devotion to God, Papa Bhiti and Deva Preeti. Swami would say that is very, very important for Sanghaniti or morality in society. Right?
Yeah, I think we were, this is where we left off even last time. We were talking about how in many senses we have crossed a line, like we are now even more unscrupulous, right? We're even more ready as a society. We give sanction to a lot of such things. We wink at it, or we, you know, turn our face away, or we find contrived ways of defending something that is indefensible, right? But nevertheless, this is a stage, like, we see it's now more prevalent than ever. Like, it's more prevalent than maybe even 3 or 4 years back.
Mm.
Right? So that in that sense, I think we can really see in crisis mode.
Mm.
Right? Like, this, if anything, I think now is the time to act. And like, you see, like climate science, the climate agreements and things like that, where even in the face of such data, like, you know, and where action has to be taken and now,
right?
Even in, at such a time, like, we are ready to defend our positions, right, instead of doing what is right. And yeah, so that is why, you know, fear of sin, that's a very, it's a concept, you know, at present, like, people might argue, you know, why should we be fearful at all? You know, on the one hand, you say that you are divinity, you are God, right? Mm-hmm. And so why should such a sacred being, like, experience fear, you know, fear of sin? But there, like, Swami is very, very clear, you know, they were talking again about in the physical state, like, so what we call as transformation in us, right, whatever it happens, like, we've discussed this earlier, when you listen to Swami's discourse, and at that moment, we feel, like, very enlightened, as if there's a lot of clarity. But for that clarity to evaporate, all it takes is a second, right? And that's why that tasmat jagrata jagrata, that is a message, core message, you know, of Shankaracharya, of Upanishads also, that you have to be so very alert, and that alertness comes from that underlying fear that I should not allow sin to penetrate. In fact, I remember Swami, he was talking about, so we talk about the 7 deadly sins. So he was describing that among them, anger.
Mm-hmm.
Anger is primary. He says, like, when you have anger, it is like that first, the thief who breaks open the house, and then the others, they, you know, they march in after the anger. So that's why Swami is to give a lot of emphasis to being in control of your temper.
Mm.
It is to say, if you lose your temper, everything else will, you know, it will follow. So that was one of the primary. So we have to be so much on guard. So like, here the word, I think the phrase fear of sin is more to be interpreted in terms of being alert or on your guard. Like, you know, so you should be so ready to guard what is inside you, that such precious jewels are there inside you, that sin can come and burglarize the whole house, right? So,
especially when Swami speaks about these 3 things, Devapriti, Papabhiti and Sanghaniti, that's a debate which is raging forever, you know, the debate between morality, ethics and legality. You know, as long as it is acceptable in the society where I'm living in, there's nothing wrong in it. You know, everybody as a community is agreeing that it's fine, and it's fine. And that is how most of the dip in morality happens.
Yes.
When it is acceptable for a majority of the people around, especially the educated mass. You know, if you have the approval of those people who are from the cream of the
opinion
society.
Opinion makers
and the elite and the liberal, then you're good to go.
Mm.
That's the danger, and that's why Swami always does not stop with Sanghaniti. Swami says, you know, the fear of sin should stop you from that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you talk of Sanghaniti, I think in one of Swami's Vahinis, probably Prem Vahini's first chapter, where Swami emphasizes this, that, you know, the fame that you have in society is very important.
Mm.
Kirti, and the other Padyam also, which Swami always refers to, you know, kirti is that which is eternal.
Hmm.
Swami would often say that, you know, if you're living in a society, and even if you decide to lead your life in such a manner that you don't get a bad name from the people around you, you will pretty much lead a righteous life.
Hmm.
Because that is how, you know, in a society, there are always people pointing fingers at you, always people trying to say that, you know, this is wrong, this is right. Even if you lead a life where at the end of your lifetime, you know, people look at you and say, you know, he's led a good life, you probably would have lived a good life. But the thing is, only if you focus on Sanghaniti, somewhere this idea that as long as I'm not caught, as long as I can get away through the, you know, nuances of legality, then probably I'm fine. Nobody can point a finger at me. That is why, you know, Swami probably brings it a little more home and puts the onus on us when he talks about fear of sin.
Yeah, because even in Manusmriti, I was reading that how Manusmriti defines dharma. Because when you talk of right and wrong, like good and bad, like, so there's something we as humans seek as, you know, like a document. Mm-hmm. So if I look at Manusmriti as a source, you know, for what dharma is, it is so very clear about this. It says that yes, what the Vedas injunct, what the scriptures injunct, but finally at the end it should be agreeable to you. You know, so that is why Swami brings in these concepts called the Swadharma, the, you know, fundamental dharma, that, mm-hmm. and the Atma dharma, that which is so consistent with you being the Atma. Mm-hmm. That's very simple. Mm-hmm. What would you do as if you were God yourself, right? So with that in mind, the Manusmriti so clearly states that, mm-hmm. that it is something that finally you should be able to live with, in other words, right? Because
exactly.
There's so many things you can't hide from yourself, no? Like, it takes a lot of effort.
Exactly. Right? The moment you say sin, you know, when you're not saying illegal or unlawful, the moment you say sin, we unconsciously attach it to something which is being recorded, even if you're doing it in private.
Right.
Right? Because the moment you say sin, you think of some Chitragupta sitting down and, you know, noting down everything that you do.
Mm.
I mean, that is the idea of sin, that something which cannot go unnoticed or unrecognized, even if you're in private, even if you're being unwatched. That is the idea of sin. It is not something that you need to fear of, or fear of hell, or fear of something like that. It is just that, as you're saying, you're answerable to yourself. And that is probably the the most, the best definition of sin that you can give.
Yeah.
Because you're always a witness to the mistakes that you're doing. And you are responsible for them. And then Swami says that it all has to have its source or base on the love for God.
Exactly.
That's why Swami always starts with, Deva Prema. And when you start with that, you actually fear is not a negative emotion.
Exactly.
But as Swami would very often put it, the fear of sin is nothing but the fear of displeasing God.
Right.
And that becomes a positive fear. It's not a fear that gives you
of retribution.
Right, exactly. It's not a fear of being punished, but it's a fear of losing something which is
not only losing, but of displeasing. See, for us, you know, one thing that would hurt us most is something we did, and, you know, God would feel hurt about that, right? And it may be something that we did right in our eyes. Like, to give an example, when the Gujarat earthquake happened in the year 2001, Bhuj, January 26th, 2001, when it took place, Swami was in Vrindavan. Because this was after the inauguration of the super speciality hospital at Whitefield, and Swami stayed on, as the hospital started functioning. We were over here, doing our MBA, I was in my MBA here, and I recall that when the earthquake took place, we all decided that we should do something towards relief. So immediately, all of us, we volunteered, whatever old clothes we had and things that, we didn't require, all of that we put together, right? And we said, managed to garner one truckload of material, and then we sent it to Gujarat, right? So Swami, he came 1 week after that to Prashanthi Nilayam. And then, very grand, there was a convoy of 75 trucks, right, which carried nearly 75,000 saris, dhotis, camp material, and so many condiments, so many things, right? So that convoy, it left from here to Bhuj. So it was flagged off with Vedam chanting and bhajans and all. And in the evening, we were sitting there for darshan, and our warden, he came to Swami. He was all smiles.
Mm-hmm.
He was about to tell Swami of what we had done. Mm-hmm. So we were sitting right in front. And then the warden told, Swami, we're very happy to see what you did today. Swami, even our boys, when you were in Vrindavan, our boys also, they got together and sent, clothes and all. And Swami asked, what? What did you say just now? He said, so we were expecting that Swami will be so happy, So I'm sitting right in front. I saw Swami's face turn into a scowl, so upset. He said, how can you all do something like this? It's as if, you haven't learned anything by watching what I do. And Swami said, I sent new clothes, right, new dhotis and new saris, and completely new material. How can you all send old clothes? Right, how can you even think of doing, offering something like that to people? See, that for me, of course, it spoke at different levels, because see, one thing, when we do charity, you know, for us, like, it is like the people, we cannot see them, they're faceless. Mm. Right, like supposing we donate over here, say we donate some equipment to the hospitals, right? So we don't actually get to see the patients who are the beneficiaries who go through it. So sometimes we might think it is quite okay, you know, we can give some refurbished or some new equipment, we can give it to the hospital. But Swami was in, first of all, when it comes to our hospitals, you're offering it to God. So there's absolutely no question of giving something that is used. It has to be completely new, right? Mm. That is the first very clear thing. Mm. But for Swami, it was more than that. More than, you know, respecting Him as the Lord Himself, right? You have to respect that they are also aspects of divinity. They are His children. As far as He was concerned, the people over there in Bhuj, for us faceless individuals, for Him they were His own children, right? Mm. And He could not bear that they, you know, it was like it was just a few seconds that reduced many of them and removed their dignity, their homes, their clothes, everything was lost. But that does not mean you can treat them that way. So you have to give them new clothes, like as if they are your own, treat them as your own. That was a very powerful example. But then we thought in our minds that we had done the right thing. Right, but in God's assessment, it is entirely different. Right, it has to conform to a far higher standard than what we hold ourselves to. So that is why that eye has to be on the Lord. You know, it cannot be on the, like, what the society thinks is all right. In this case, our seniors, our faculty, none of them could see that anything in that was wrong. You know, this would have made news. We could have easily publicized and said, many do. Right, but for Swami, as Lord Himself, that was not acceptable. So that is something very, I think that's why that love of God, as you said, is the primary factor here. Right, that dictates the other things. Like, why would you even want to follow Dharma? Right, as you can see in the world, if you want to succeed, so-called, I mean, like, you know, it's like that when they say, when Yudhishthira, at the end of the Mahabharata, So the Pandavas have started walking on their final journey, right? And you know that one by one the other brothers, they all die during the journey. But finally it is Yudhishthira who bodily, in his physical body, he reaches the heavenly abode. But what happens is Yama plays a small deceptive trick on him. So he shows him, the first thing he shows is Duryodhana sitting there happily in heaven, enjoying like all the, you know, the same riches, everything that he used to enjoy on earth, a hundredfold he's enjoying here in the heavens. So then he begins to inquire, where are my brothers, you know, like those who followed Dharma throughout, and he shows them being tormented in hell, right? So, and he says, you also have to spend one day here in hell. And he spends it. Of course, the reason is that he played a deceptive trick on Ashwatthama during the war. So you have to go through this. But Yama says the whole thing was a deception. Like, I wanted to just test you also, right? On even at this stage, will you hold on to Dharma or not, right? Or in your mind, do you hold Dharma as primary or not? So many of us get deceived by that. We look at, you know, people who flouted Dharma and they are like, they enjoy their life and everything is like in our minds having a great life out there. Correct. But this is what the story shows, that, you know, that is deceptive. You are being fooled. So what is important is Dharma. Finally, that test we must hold on to.
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to that Gujarat thing, you know, as you were saying, the different levels in which Swami was sending out that message, Swami did not simply send out trucks, you know. You know that Swami's Sevadal are there all over the place. Even if the trucks are sent to Gujarat, there are enough people to distribute it and distribute it in the manner that Swami would like it. But Swami did not simply send it off. Swami sent somebody none less than Chiranjeev Rao Garu, almost like, you know, the main person in the ashram. the authority, and Swami also sent one of his students.
Yes.
You know, a senior research scholar.
And one of the Hyderabad youth leaders.
Right,
also.
Right. And yeah. Swami is clearly sending out the message that, you know, I mean, it's not just material coming to you. It is not old material, first of all, as you're saying, it's all brand new. But I'm sending it with people who are really dear to me.
Yeah.
Right. And saying that it's just short of me not being able to come there, I'm sending the people who are dearest to me.
Mm.
That message, you know. And this thing of, you know, always turning to Swami, because many times we end up finding company which agrees with what we do, right? If we have a lower sense of morality, we tend to be in the group of people who all think in the same manner. So if you do something wrong, and you eventually will turn to the friends around you and they'll say, yeah, it's fine. So you almost, you know, ensure that you don't get, you know, pulled out of that comfort zone of
echo chamber,
you know, lower, exactly, an echo chamber kind of a thing. But that is why when you turn to Swami for checking whether your actions are right or wrong, that is the best way of doing it. I was listening to the talk given by Dr. U.S. Rouse's daughter. You know, he has two daughters. One daughter is in the general hospital and the elder one is a professor in the Anantapur campus. So she was telling the younger daughter when she was pursuing her medicine,
mm-hmm.
It seems in the fourth year of medicine,
mm-hmm.
There was some rumor and there was a circular around which came by which said that you have to pay this much money
mm-hmm.
if you have to clear the exam.
Mm-hmm.
And that was clearly a violation of what was in the law. And I mean, there was nothing legal about it or moral about it. They just said that you have to pay this sum of money if you want to clear your fourth year. If you want to become a doctor, you have to pay this to the institution. And I think in the whole class, only four of them said that we won't. And in the four which said that we won't, I think two could not afford that money. Right? They said, no, we can't pay this. We've already taken a loan and all of that. But two of them, in principle, they said, no, we can't do this. This is not right. We can't pay. So apparently, she had called up Dr. U.S. Rao and was telling him, see, there is a possibility that I might, after 4 years, not become a doctor.
Mm.
And is that okay? And she said, this is what is happening, and I've told them that I won't pay. So immediately, Dr. Yusuf, you know, he told her that, you know, at the end of all of this, you have to come and look at Swami's face. You have to show your face to Swami.
Mm.
So never forget that. So forget, you know, you not clearing, even if you don't become a doctor, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
But you have to come and show your face here to Swami. That is more important than anything else. I think that is what actually will fortify this idea of morality also. The feeling that eventually I'm answerable to Swami. And, you know, I could please everybody around me. I could get everybody to tell me that what I've done is right. But at the end of the day, am I in the right frame to come and face Swami and be clear about it?
So the touchstone always has to be Bhagwan. Always we should look at his standards.
Right.
So that is the final test.
Exactly.
And so that's why very clearly, unequivocally, Swami, he begins when he says that sadhana is important, right? And he says, despite ceaseless spiritual practice, people are unable to achieve the purity they desire. Because we are not clear what the goal of spiritual practice is. Because we take that the goal could be the number of hours of meditation we spend in, or the number of times we have rotated the beads, right? And Swami says, like, again, very, very clearly he says that what is meant by spiritual practice is not recitation of the name, meditation, or singing of devotional songs, yoga, even good deeds.
Hmm.
He asks, do these constitute spiritual practice? Not at all, he says. And he goes on to say that the true spiritual practice is transforming bad into good and sorrow into happiness.
Right.
So those are Swami's standards, right? Not the what the world thinks
right.
as spiritual. And this, if you remember, it was also there in the Keno Upanishad, right? that the world may think that these are spiritual practices, but ultimately the ultimate objective of spiritual practice must be God Himself and nothing else. Nothing short of that. Not the riches that you accumulate in this world and not the good life that you aspire to in the next world. Right?
Mm.
So those are actions you perform and the society may hail you as a righteous person, a person who does good karma. But in the eyes of the Lord, there's still a gap. Right?
Mm.
And that gap is whether the spiritual practice is addressed to win the love of God. So that is the So Swami says that, so ultimately what pleases Bhagwan the most, Swami used to say, is your transformation.
Right.
What I seek is your transformation. And that is the best offering we can give. Right.
Most often, I think that is the problem, is, you know, especially when Swami is referring to the Navaveda Bhakti, which of course Swami has spoken about extensively and praising all of those practices of, you know, Shravanam, Kirtanam and Bhajans and Seva. But here Swami is saying that even that is not spiritual practice as such. That is only a means. I mean, that is an exercise that you undertake, but real sadhana is something which happens within. And I think the rest of the discourse is going to be about that, or at least a good part of the rest of the discourse is going to be about that. But even before that, I mean, that's always what we do. You know, today what we call yoga. You know, we practice yoga. I think the yoga day is coming next month. But what we refer to as yoga is probably such a small part of what Patanjali set out to explain as yoga. Right? What asanas which we do and pranayama which we do is not even 1/8 of what yoga is about.
Correct.
And it's not even about the quantity wise it's 1/8. When the goal is not what the goal was meant to be, I mean, even if it is 1/8, it's not quantitatively also that amount. It's much lesser than that.
Yes.
So you take yoga as a means of toning your body. But yoga was a means of you know, taking care of your body so that you don't have to worry about that and you can do greater things.
Precisely.
And that idea is completely lost. And that is why it's important to, you know, probably have somebody like Swami telling us that, look, this is what sadhana is. And if you go on doing this, it's not going to make any difference to you unless and until you come to the, you know, crux of the thing and say that this is why I'm doing sadhana, this is why I'm doing bhajan, this is why I'm doing seva. And that's precisely what stands out. You know, whenever you talk about seva, from Swami's point of view, it's never about doing charity at all. I mean, going back to that same idea of the Gujarat relief which Swami did, for Swami, it was never about, you know, being charitable, giving somebody something in their need. It was never like that. It's a completely comprehensive idea of, I am doing an act. Does it have the approval? Is it right for me to do this? It's much beyond the idea of just doing service. And I think that is what Swami wants us to bring in every activity. Before this part, of course, you know, Swami is talking in that second padyam which Swami sang. There Swami was referring to going back to the same thing of, you know, education that we pursue, and that education is not what gives us happiness. And Swami says that you've mastered all the sciences, you pride yourself of all your learnings. After having done all this, if you're not able to join your palms together and express devotion to God, aren't all your studies a complete waste?
Right.
Yeah. I think it's a very different take on studies itself. Because nowadays, the more you learn, the more you tend to move away from ideas such as devotion and surrender and all that. Swami is saying that the more you learn, the more you should find reason to do that. You should find more logic in having surrender to God and having devotion to God.
Right. Because I think that is what the one of the excellent features of this institute was, right? That you can, on the one hand, there was the pursuit of academics, like especially the sciences which call for a lot of rigor, and Swami would back it to the hilt. Like, we had very good faculty in the sciences and such top class instrumentation. At no point, you know, did Swami say that no, right, that we, this is limited and you should limit yourself only to this. He would take pride in students' achievements. I remember when one of the physics faculty, he got an opportunity to visit Hungary for a conference, and Swami actually made it a point that the entire assembly in Kulwanthal should know about it. Right? Swami was so happy at that achievement of a very young, you know, teacher in that department. Right? And so in that sense, Swami did encourage so much. But then Swami said, you should strike a balance. In the sense, there is something that the sciences are good to a certain extent, right? But beyond that, there is something it misses, right? So the concept of scientism, right? Where you only take as true what can be measured, seen, felt, right? So that, it has its own merits because, you know, people don't get duped, etc. But then it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Right. So Swami says that you should not miss out, that there are some things, as the Upanishads have continually said, that are even beyond the mind itself. Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha, the mind itself cannot reach. And we are using one small part of the mind to kind of understand what the physical phenomena is. Not all of us can even like do it, you know, like there are very few geniuses who are able to, you know, exploit the full capabilities of the mind, right? Mm. And even that is not sufficient, the Upanishads say, for comprehending what goes beyond the mind.
Mm.
So that's why Swami says, like, that has to, you have to strike a balance between this, the physical aspect, what you're studying and what your academics, give it its due. Pursue the excellence there, but at the same time, do not neglect this. But as you rightly pointed out, the world is taking that as an excuse nowadays to discard religion altogether.
Right.
Organized religion does have its faults, but at its basis, at its core, what it was meant to achieve is something that perhaps the scientific or material approach will never be able to achieve.
Right. The whole idea, you know, the very fact that the moral fabric is kind of breaking apart is the idea that you're moving away from religion. You know, religion is not perfect because religion is done and being ruled by men, and men are not perfect.
Yeah.
You know, that is the final thing, and that is what we're missing out.
Mm.
As you were referring to the climate change debate which is happening, you know, one of the things which is coming out and which is very, very saddening to note is some of the scientific studies themselves being fudged so much, you know, which means you have men of science who are actually held high for their integrity,
correct,
now compromising that.
Exactly.
Right? So that doesn't mean you point discuss fingers science at science itself.
Yeah.
And the same thing we're doing to religion, you know, we have definitely had, you know, less than perfect men preaching religion, and which has caused a lot of problem. But that does not mean the very principle of religion, the very principle of devotion and love for God is bad.
Mm.
And as you're saying, we're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That's exactly what you're doing. And going back to what Swami is talking about, you know, when you refer to Swami's way of teaching secular education or giving secular education its place, you know, whenever you talk of education, we always use the word empowerment. You know, if you want to empower a minority, you want to empower a certain section of society, we find ways of giving them an access to education, because there is no empowerment which is better than that.
Mm.
So when that is the case, I think in one of the discourses Swami says that, you know, it is meant to empower you, but it only causes fear in you. It only causes the idea that if you don't acquire this education, if you don't earn money, if you don't do this, what will happen to you? But the empowerment which Swami gives in this particular Padyam, Swami says that, he says, your stomach is so tiny, it's few inches long, stomach.
Mm.
And I've heard Swami saying this so many times, and every time he says this, there was nothing more empowering than this particular idea, that you have a tiny stomach and you don't need to do much to fill it up.
Correct.
Right? They, I mean, it literally frees you up. He said, you don't need all of your learning to fill the tiny stomach. That all of that learning can be, you know, used for doing much more things than just filling that stomach.
Yes.
So that is probably the most empowering idea that Swami gave us. That don't worry about your food, don't worry about your well-being. You have enough talent in you to fill your few inches long stomach and the few inches long stomachs of all people who are dependent on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably such a freeing idea. And then you're free to ask that, what am I supposed to do with my learning, right?
But that takes an enormous amount of humility and an enormous amount of faith in the Lord's words, you know, because he's telling you that, and it's because the rest of society, what it is telling you is you got to earn so much more, right? There's so much pressure actually, like to acquire things, to keep up with the Joneses, as they say, right? So that kind of pressure when it is facing you, and you have to look away from it all and only look at Bhagavan.
Mm.
Now that calls for an enormous amount of courage, right? Because like many of us do experience this, you know, earlier Swami used to be so very particular that, you know, when you are here in Prashanti Nilayam, like your entire focus should be on Bhagavan so much for us students, staff, you know, that we should not venture out too much. Right, like any time we had to go out, we had to ask Swami's permission.
Mm.
And that was a way to keep the whole thing in check, that we don't go out too much, we don't get influenced by the false values which society holds as dear.
Right. Right.
And because Swami had a particular intention, right, when he sets up an ashram, there's a particular kind of life that he intends that you lead. And that can very easily, it's a very fragile ecosystem, you know. So it takes a lot of effort, a lot of understanding, a lot of clarity to keep that ecosystem in place, right? And that ecosystem is you as well as your surroundings. So it that's why it's very important for us to keep discussing about what Swami has said on these aspects. So we become clear what was Swami's intention, right?
I was just reading this article, I think today or yesterday, about censorship on TV in the 1950s and 60s. The kind of words which are not supposed to be used, the kinds of scenes which are not supposed to be shown.
Yeah.
And they were very strict. You know, now it that article was almost mocking at the level of censorship in those days. But you know, if you look at it, here was a very, you know, conscious producers or whatever you call that of these TV shows or the censorship board, which said that, you know, let's not send out these messages to the people because this is mass media. A lot of people are going to see, so let's not send out this message. I think over the years we have come to the idea that no, if you're beyond 35 it's okay, if you're beyond 20 it's okay. Now we're saying it's beyond 16 it's okay, but we don't realize that that's probably the most dangerous age, 16 and 18, that's the most dangerous age. And we're going out and saying that, you know, let's put out everything there. Now you are wise enough to choose. But the fact is none of us really are wise enough to choose. You know, when we were with Swami in our that age group between 18 to 22 or whatever it is, we knew the vulnerabilities which we were, you know, subjected to if you're outside. And that's why Swami would constantly say. And I recall one thing which Swami would very often tell, especially when we come back from vacation or when you're going for vacation. He says, you know, this place is like a garage. You come here and I, you know, tinker you up and I make you a very good vehicle. And for 2 months I send you out and you come back in the same condition in which you came to me in the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And Swami said that you should try to avoid that.
Yeah, because strangely enough, the society is okay with the concept of a diet where you impose restrictions on what you eat, you know, so that you remain healthy for long. But the same thing, the moment when it comes to entertainment, like the society fights for the exact opposite. You know, that you should have unlimited access and of any form of entertainment. That is a pretty strange thing to watch, that you have standards for one which you think is vital for your well-being. But when only it takes somebody like Swami to recognize the entire dimension of what constitutes well-being, only he can see. Like, because as we have seen earlier, when, I mean, the evidence is right in front of our eyes when the summer course is intended for young people. He is called young people there. And for Swami, that age group was so very vital, no? Like, he used to say that this is like a fence that is around a young sapling. Because it is at that, when it is at that stage, if it is not protected, like he would say, you know, the goats, cattle will come and eat it up, and there's no chance for that to bloom into a tree. Right? So Swami wanted to afford every youth that chance. And I can see it, you know, when I was doing my engineering, believe me, I have seen the brightest of the bright, like, you know, how they lost their way. It is like, at age 17 or 18, such brilliant potential they have walked in with. And at the end of 4 years, they walked out like as shells of themselves, completely wasted by, you know, pursuits like after lust or after drink. And it's such a pathetic thing to watch, right? And I think the entire society must then wake up and say, this is, I'm talking about nearly 20 years ago, and it's all the more prevalent now. Right, and that is something like, which is why, you know, although it is not so fashionable, it is not so trendy to talk about this. Even it's the present, you see, even the present,
not politically right to say.
No, politically right, yeah. But it is very necessary to go back to look at what it is that the sages had in mind, what it is that the spiritual personages have in mind, and even I could even look at the present, you know, like breed of so-called spiritual gurus. But what happens is even they have fallen into the trap of confirming with
extreme dilution to
confirming with what society wants to hear. But the Upanishads have a completely different intent. They might, it might fly in the face of what you think is palatable, but
absolutely.
Yeah,
and I think probably in closing, all that I can say is thanks to our listeners who are, you know, ready to listen to us speaking of such things, you know, definitely in a sense, they don't show any resentment by saying, of course, there are some random mails which come now and then saying that this is too conservative and this view is too old-fashioned, but 99.9% of our listeners agree with this, not because it's you and me sitting here and speaking, it's because Swami himself has said it, and if we are not able to agree with it or if we are not able to accept it completely, it means there's something wrong in our understanding. And I think at least as devotees, many of us have that maturity. And it's so important, you know, as we said, 20 years later, this discourse, the pain which Swami is expressing in the form of what he is saying, what has happened in the modern times, is as relevant today as it was then, and I'm sure it's going to be more relevant in the days to come. So, and on behalf of all of us, we express heartfelt gratitude to Swami for not saying, you know, something which is pleasing to us, but saying that what we all need to hear, and giving us the opportunity to hear that again and again. So, dear listeners, and with gratitude to all of you for tuning in week after week, we offer this humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Sai Prakash for the last segment of the day, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. He's going to continue talking about the Sai Symphony program, which was organized in Swami's presence for the 90th birthday. But do join us again next week at 7:30 for the next episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam.